Invest in someone who wants to take your job. I love that. You know what that reminds me of? Star Wars, the Sith rule of two. Right?
Oh, really?
Like every Sith Lord chooses an apprentice that eventually kills them. Hey folks, welcome back to Executive Runtime. Today, I'm joined by Steven Avage, who is the Chief Marketing Officer at Best Egg, where he leads marketing for one of the fastest growing personal lending platforms. He's a P&L leader with experience across fintech, consulting, and major financial institutions like JPMorgan Chase. Plus, he's an active entrepreneur and board member. Steven, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Johnny. Appreciate it. Excited to be on the show.
So you started your career, early on you were doing analyst roles at like Bank of America, and now you're a CMO at Best Egg. Can you walk through maybe some of the pivotal moments that helped transform you from an operational focused individual contributor to a P&L leader?
Yeah, thanks. There's definitely a lot of moments. And thinking about the ones that were most impactful, I would say when I first started my career, I was fortunate enough to be part of a management rotational program with a company that got acquired by MBNA in 2005 called MBNA. And essentially what that program did was put you in the first half of the program, you were in the frontline role. So you were taking calls from customers, listening to their challenges, having to deal with their challenges on the phone without a whole lot of training. So you kind of were thrown into the fire. So you could really understand what it took, right, to serve the customer well and do it very well. And then on the flip side, you would then spend a short time in that same area. Say you're in customer service, you take some calls for a while, and then you become a manager in that frontline area. So not only are you understanding the details of the job and all what it takes to succeed at the, call it analyst or level or associate level, you then also understood what it took to motivate, lead, and guide people to get the best, you know, out of them, right, in terms of doing their jobs well, but then also helping them get fulfillment from the role. So that was one that I say in terms of just understanding the bridge between knowing how to do your job well, right, on the operational side, and then being able to lead and manage as well. That was one pivotal moment, I would say. Second one would be getting my MBA from work. Absolutely was one of the best decisions I made in my life, and a great investment. I would say personal investments, both for both me and my wife, I would say, because she had to go through that that 2-year period with me as well. And it just opened many doors for me from a career perspective. But without that MBA, I don't think I would have had the chance to actually do my 2-year stint in consulting as I did. And I think also opened up to other roles in terms of leadership in the later part of my career. And then finally, I would say Best Egg, joining Best Egg the first time, where I was thrown into the world of finance and, you know, forecasting and planning, where I didn't really have any experience, but it was basically the trust that I had done, you know, certain things. I had an MBA and I had also spent time at Deloitte, gave me that credibility to jump into a role like that. And then that transitioned into me really understanding that I wanted to be a P&L leader at some point. I think after getting exposure within FP&A, that's the beauty of the FP&A role, is that it basically gives you a world view, a very well-rounded view of what it takes for a business to succeed. Because you have to understand what's happening in marketing, what's happening in operations, what's happening in credit, all those pieces in order to build the P&L and build the forecast. And then you are also in the position to challenge both functional and business leaders, right, to ensure that their plans are aligning with the vision and the growth objectives of, you know, the core leadership team. So I would say those are three key moments that stand out that were very effective in helping me get where I am.
One thing I wanted to ask about was you mentioned early on the rotational leadership program you participated in. As also a graduate of one of those programs. I mean, those are like, you know, what the big companies did back in the day.
That's
maybe
true.
They still do. And I talked to a bunch of people who went through those programs early on. I know for myself personally, you know, I was not really tracking that whole world early on. I was basically kind of picked out of a group of peers and told my manager said that, you know, you should be in this program. But I'm curious for you, how did that come about? Was this something that was planned or were you chosen? How did that work?
You know, it was interesting. I first started at MBNA as an intern, actually, and I joined as an intern in a program called the Thurgood Marshall Scholarship Fund Scholarship Program. So Thurgood Marshall Scholarship Fund, I believe, still is around. They support, students who primarily are at HBCUs, and they provide you either scholarships. In this case, it was an internship with a Fortune 500 company at the time. So through that program, I got exposed to this rotational program that was available. So similar to you, I was encouraged to apply for the program. And I was fortunate to land the role. So I had maybe I showed some promise within that internship. And I was one of a handful of people that were asked to apply for the program.
Cool. Funny how that works out.
Yes.
So jumping from Bank of America to Barclays, that was a bit of a significant move for you. You know, how did you build the skills and credibility needed to lead marketing analytics for, you know, their airline and travel portfolio?
Yeah, so I would say I already had a baseline. Mm-hmm. I had background in analytics because even at Bank of America at the time, I was in operations, but really focused on, you know, leveraging analytics to understand, you know, where there were problem spots in terms of cost. And then, you know, really helping the leadership team analyze and identify areas of opportunity, right, cost reduction, even revenue generation in some cases, and understanding customer pain points and satisfaction as well. So I had a baseline experience that I brought to the table, but then I also had credentials, if you will, from an educational perspective. So I was a computer science major, even though I tell people I never wrote like a line of code professionally, other than, you know, SQL scripts, and once things got to Python, I ran away.
Much of the world still runs on SQL, so there you go.
There you go. So maybe I could still be dangerous. But that said, I think I had that, and at the time I joined Barclays, I had just graduated from Drexel with a master's in information systems. And that, I think, was just coming fresh out of that program. Drexel is very well recognized, for their co-op program. And Drexel also has some connections to Barclays time. So I think that the combination of the baseline experience I was bringing to the table and the credentials in terms of my education were very helpful. And I'll also add that I had a hiring manager that maybe saw something in me and was willing to, you know, take a chance on me and invest in me. And till this day, he's someone I still look at as a mentor because he played a pivotal role in my career.
Yeah, that's a good segue. I was going to ask, right, you know, we often, you know, look back at our backgrounds and credit ourselves for a lot of our success. But most of the time, it's like those one or two people that saw something in you that you didn't see in yourself. And it sounds like this manager was at least one of those people. Was there anyone else that just sort of like took a chance on you that really helped shape your early success?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll say early on, if I go back to that, you know, rotational program, there were two people that ran the Thurgood Marshall Scholarship Fund internship program with MBNA that really early on told me. In fact, I still remember a conversation with one of them where she said, you know, I think you're just geared to be more on an analyst, right? Because the program was really geared to lead you into this rotational program where you manage in the line, and then over time you build, you know, leadership within the operational areas, and then maybe you branch into marketing eventually or something else. But early on, she was like, yeah, I could see you doing something in finance or, you know, maybe marketing, but really from that analytical perspective, she was, so she saw something there. And then the other person, she really was one of those people that I believe advocated for me to get to not only apply for that program, but once I was in it, she would pull me outside every once in a while and just give me good advice. She set me up with, you know, other leaders, you know, folks who were really influential leaders in the organization, to give me that visibility that, as you know, is very important. One, just understanding how people got where they were, but then two, having people who know who you are, know your name, and, you know, could maybe at some point be sponsors for you. I think those are two people early on. And then I'm purposely not mentioning names just because I didn't ask permission from folks, but they know who they are. But my manager at Barclays was another one. He was one that really, I would say what I learned the most from him was how to treat people, how to lead people, how to really understand what drives people in and lean into that in a way that just inspires them to bring their best to work every day, but then also giving them space to be themselves. Understand who they are. Okay, these are your strengths. These are where you need to improve. I'm going to invest in you to improve on the areas of improvements. And then I will set goals for you. I will set the bar high. I will put you in front of places where you may be uncomfortable, but these are learning opportunities. And just giving you the space to grow. And also not, one thing I also credit him was he had no ego when it came to giving you the space to showcase your work, right? Because you see that in corporate America where, you know, the folks who do the work, they do the presentations and all that, and then they hand it off to the leader to go present. No, he always brought you to the table so that you got credit for you what you were doing. And he wasn't worried about, oh, this person is now going to outshine, right? So I really, really appreciated that from him. And, you know, I can name other people later on in my career, but I would say in terms of, you know, folks who really helped change the trajectory of, you know, my leadership style and how I wanted to either chart the course of my career, number one, but then two, more importantly, how I wanted to be. Those folks were really important.
Yeah. You mentioned leadership a few times. I kind of want to lean into that a little bit. Talk to me a little bit about your leadership style. What have you found to work? Are you more, you know, an empowering leader? Are you, you know, just talk to me about like what's your approach, particularly when you're building a new team or you inherit a new team, how do you establish yourself?
Yes, I would say there's certain principles that I have. I think I've built, again, learning from others for sure. I think number one is just treat others how you want to be treated. I am not, I hate micromanagement with a passion. So I'd rather have people around me that I know I trust can do the job. And then I get out of the way until they ask for my help and my input. And then, you know, we take it from there. I would say I also am someone who sets the bar very high. I'm setting it high for everyone, including myself, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm going to hold people accountable to that bar, including myself as well. And I think once people understand that, you will also hold yourself accountable as well. People respond very positively to that. Recognizing that you don't have all the answers is really important. So that way you're able to build a team around you that complements you. Is important. And then, you know, this is something, if I think back to the manager I recently described, you know, investing in people who want to take your jobs. I know it sounds crazy, but it's motivating, right? Because if you think about it, you know, you want someone who is hungry, who is, you know, about growing themselves and continuing to improve themselves such that you look back and say, oh, wait, I'm certainly not growing as fast as I could be. If, you know, so I create space for them to take on that next challenge. Because, you know, so it's something I've always employed as I, you know, I've grown to, I've been fortunate to lead teams over it. And then, you know, in terms of, you said something about a new team, the number one and most important thing is just investing a lot of time early on to really understand everyone, because people are different. People are motivated by different things. People respond differently to feedback, depending on how it's delivered. So really understanding and investing that time to understand what makes it tick is important. And then, like I said, understanding where their strengths are, where their opportunities for growth are, and taking the time to invest in them. And also giving them space to just then execute, be themselves, and live full lives in terms of a work-life balance. And once those things are in place, you know, people will go to bat for you no matter what, because they know that you care.
Yeah, yeah. Invest in someone who wants to take your job. I love that. You know what that reminds me of? Star Wars, the Sith rule of two. Right? Oh, like every Sith Lord chooses an apprentice that eventually kills them. Hopefully I have my Star Wars lore right there.
Nice.
All the geeks will get me if I don't, but man, that's great advice.
Awesome.
Yeah, so eventually you transition to consulting. What was the impetus around that transition, and what was that like to kind of go in an environment where, you know, you're one level removed from complete ownership, but you have one foot in? But I'm curious on how you approach that style of working.
Yes. So two things. So there are two questions in there. So the first one, the answer to the first one is, I really, once I was done with my MBA, or towards the end of my MBA, I was really considering, I had to really do a lot of introspection and say, what do I really want to do next? Want to continue down the path that I was at Barclays and continue growing within the company, or try something different? Up to that point, all my career was in financial services. And as I navigated the MBA program, I learned more about consulting, and it felt as an exciting space to be in, because you could learn a lot about a lot in a very short period of time. Right. So you could have exposure to different industries, different business problems, all within the umbrella of one company. And that was very attractive to me. So the motivation was to go out there and get exposure to a broad set of industries and make a choice to say, do I want to branch out and do something else? Or is financial services really the space where I want to be? And that, again, another beautiful thing about consulting is not everybody goes into it wanting to just rise to the rank of being a partner or something like that. There are folks that go in with a clear understanding that, no, I'm going in to get this out of it and exit. And that was what eventually happened for me. Even though early on I thought I could keep going down the path, but very quickly life reminded me that, you know, I probably started down that journey too late, because at the time I joined, it was I joined in August of 2012. And my daughter was born in May of 2012. So within those 2 years, I spent little time with her at home, and that was painful. So by the time I was in my second year, I knew I was going to make a transition, and, you know, the best tech came calling, and the rest is history there. So that's the first question in terms of why I made that transition. And the other thing, in terms of the other question around lack of complete ownership and all that, I think I don't know if I would say it was lack of complete ownership, because I felt ownership of the project we were working on. Now, you may be alluding to the fact that when you're strategy consulting, you may not own the implementation, and that's fair. But what I would say, Deloitte at the time was, dare I say, trailblazer in the way they organize their strategy projects, where they not only will, you know, have a strategy recommendation, but they would partner with you on execution as well. Now, more and more of the top consulting firms are starting to do that kind of work, or, you know, since then, but Deloitte at that time was doing more of that kind of work. So that made it even more exciting for me. So on the day-to-day, it was, hey, you come in, you might be on a different project on a different team, but it just mm-hmm. made the dynamism of all of that just made it really exciting because, you know, you don't know what problem you would be solving in 3 months or in 6 months. So you have to get in, learn very quickly, build trust quickly, and then, you know, really do the analysis, understand what recommendations are. But on the Deloitte side, the difference was they had to be actionable because either you were going to be a part of it or there was a team that you were going to hand off to that was going to drive that execution.
Yeah. 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 After doing a little bit of digging, I saw that, you know, while you were there, you delivered $60 million in pricing improvements for a client. You know, how do you approach these high stakes engagements where like failure is not an option, right? There's a lot on the line.
Yeah. I would say, well, is a team. The team delivers, you know, that those savings. And I would say it really comes down to early on building trust with the client. So understanding, you know, what the problem space is, really identifying who the key players are, not just the key decision makers, but who really knows, dare I say, where the bodies are buried, right? Because that's where you start uncovering the areas of opportunity. So spending time with those folks and making sure they feel like they are a part of the solution by bringing them along in the journey. So we need some data for analysis. Okay. I'm not just going to say, hey, send me this data. Hey, okay, what systems are you pulling this data from? Let's work on this together. Okay, we're going to share a readout to senior leaders. Hey, well, let's work on this deck together, or I'll work on the deck. Let's talk through it. And then I'm going to bring you to the meeting because you have more context than I can ever get in a matter of weeks, right? So building that trust, bringing them along the journey is helpful because they would then, those folks that you're bringing along the journey give you that credibility, right? When you come to the table. But I think for that particular project that you referenced, I think one of the things that made it really work was we were able to set up experiments in a localized way where you could observe in one area, hey, how would this work? What kind of value can we get? Okay, once we understood that, then that can be scaled across whether it's other regions, other business units, or elsewhere. But really the learning around that is, you know, setting up experiments that allow you to learn and fail quickly and iterate quickly as well.
Yep.
So I think those approaches was what helped us to be successful in that project.
Yeah. Cool. So eventually you did make the transition from Deloitte and you went to Best Dig. At the time was Marlette Funding. And you built a strategic planning function. I'm curious on, you know, why that move and how did it come along? Were you hired specifically for that role or was this something you just thought needed to be done? I'm curious how that came about.
Yeah, so that was my role, first role right after Deloitte. And I was hired specifically to do that role. Till this day, I still wonder why. Because I had zero experience in finance, but like I said, I had the MBA and of course, coming from Deloitte, I think the understanding, or there was some trust and belief that, well, if you could do all those things, you can figure this out. But when I'll also add that I had a really good manager who very quickly I was able to build trust with and again, gave me space to kind of operate I was very upfront about what I knew and what I didn't know. So I had to learn quickly and also build a team that complemented me, especially in areas where I wasn't strong. So in the FDNA role, at least at the time, there were some areas that you needed a strong accounting call it domain expertise or knowledge in order to do the job well. So one of the things I had to prioritize was hiring someone who was not necessarily an accountant, but had enough exposure to, you know, those accounting principles and handling some of the, call it the complex financial reporting we had to do. Bringing someone like that onto the team was very, very helpful. Bringing someone else that was a strong data analyst to help us build the infrastructure on which, you know, all of our finance and financial analytics would sit was also critical. So those were some of the things that helped me navigate that role. But I would say it was, you know, that phone call was mainly one because of the network, right? The Barclays network, if you know Best Egg, the Barclays network is very strong at Best Egg. So a lot of the founders were Barclays alumni, and I had a relationship with some of the folks. So I think my name came up in conversations and hence the outreach. But the rest of it was just faith that I could get the job done. And for me personally, I think keys to success there were what I mentioned, understanding what I didn't know so I could build a team to complement that. And having a manager that really, you know, trusted me and gave me the space to do that.
Yeah. And so now you're in marketing, right? At Best Egg, formerly Marlette. Like how did that come about, and how do you like that as compared to what you've done in the past and like analytics?
Yes. So it's, so marketing, I think this particular role, my boss, when your boss asks you to do something, you know, at some point you just do it. Yeah. So it happened in that way. But I would say, so your question is, how is it different and what do I enjoy about it? One, what I really, the most important thing I enjoy is that I get to learn something new again. Now, marketing is not entirely new to me. My role at JPMorgan Chase 3 years ago was really centered around that, even though it expanded to touch, you know, certain areas like customer experience as well. But primarily my job was around, you know, growing the portfolio, and it was all around marketing acquisition and portfolio strategy as well. So, and of course I had my role at Barclays that was about marketing analytics. So all of those experiences were, gave me a foundation I could, you know, build upon. So really the learning for me now is like, okay, wait, what has changed in the past 3 years? And yes, a lot has changed. Whether it's search, whether it's, you know, the channels we operate in now versus, you know, versus those that were available, right, back then. Some channels are more prominent now than others. For example, and even Best Egg itself as a brand, we've evolved since, you know, the time I was first at Best Egg. So all of those things are new things that I'm learning and growing with the team on. So that's been, you know, exciting. Leading a much larger team than I was leading in my more recent role at Best Egg was also a relatively new challenge as well. So, and it's a very diverse team, right? You're working, on one hand, you have creatives, right? Who, you know, there's a stereotypical way you look at creatives, but they just look at things differently, and they measure, they have different metrics and different measures of success. Than say, all the way on the other end, I also have a marketing analytics team that, you know, just operates very different as well. So how do you manage across all of that was a new, an exciting challenge for me as well. And this is another thing I would say, being in the functional area, is just also kind of owning more of your value chain versus in the GM space. You are, I've always described it as, you are the conductor in an orchestra, right? So everybody has their role, and you're just, you know, basically, you know, directing everyone, you know, when they need to play whatever instrument they're playing, which is, again, empowering, because ultimately you're responsible for the entire music and how it comes to life. But here, if I'm playing, you know, tambourine, I got to play it really well and have that deep domain knowledge within marketing. So I think it's very exciting. And I would say, as I think about, you know, this role within the context of my broader career, having that background in finance and operations, and now even deepening my experience in marketing, I think all of those things come together to really still map back to, you know, this idea that, you know, I am more of a general manager than, you know, a specific, you know, functional leader in this particular space. Because I think all the experiences I've had actually make me even more effective in marketing, because when I talk with other functional leaders or with the, with our president or the GMs, I can speak their language very effectively. So it enables me to be a more, you know, effective CMO, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. So you've had some board experiences as well. Can you talk a little bit about those, or those was more on the nonprofit side, corporate, and how did you balance that with your, you know, your big executive role, and how does that contribute to your leadership development?
Yeah, so I have a couple of board roles on the nonprofit side. So I am on the board of my daughter's school, St. Anne's Episcopal School here in Middletown, Delaware. I am also on the board of the Christina Cultural Arts Center in Delaware as well. And on the, as well as Danny Foundation, actually, which is a foundation, a research institute. Well, it's a foundation that supports Danny Institute, which is a research institute that my older sister established, you know, to build research capacity. And it essentially is a think tank in Nigeria. So I have, you know, have quite a few exposure. And then, of course, I'm on the board of two for-profit organizations. I'm also focused in doing work in Nigeria. So you can see a theme here where, you know, yes, there's the local impact that I'm really trying to drive through the Christina Cultural Center, as well as with St. Anne's Episcopal School, but I still have those strong ties to, you know, my to Nigeria. You know, I was born and raised there, and I still have a lot of connections back there. So those board positions help me to stay connected, both from a business perspective and also from a social impact perspective. So that's really been exciting. Now, in terms of lessons that I take back to my role at Best Egg, is pretty broad. I think number one is just the dynamics can be so different in the nonprofit world. So learning to be able to, you know, dial up certain aspects of your personality and dial them down in the appropriate times is is critical for success, I would say, in nonprofit leadership, because you understand that, you know, in some areas, especially in education, the pace is very different. So, you know, I'm like, oh yeah, we can do this. We should do it. We can accomplish this yesterday. You know, what's going on? But it's like, no, it's a process we got to walk through, right? And you have to be respectful of that. So, and I think that level of, you know, kind of understanding the nuance, bringing that back to, you know, even my team when I'm working with them and understand, okay, I can see that they have a different perspective and they bring something different to the table. You know, I have to create space for that, right? To be able to receive that. And then doing business in Nigeria is, you know, it's a very dynamic, you know, marketplace. There's a lot that, you know, a lot of things that may be in your control versus not being your control, and being able to navigate that complex environment, I think sometimes makes my job easier, right? At Best Egg, because like, I've done this over here. This is nothing. So it feels like it gives you more of that confidence that it doesn't matter what challenge comes at you, you can figure a way through it with the right, you know, folks.
For the folks who are interested in the particularly the nonprofit board space, how does one get plugged into that world? How do those roles come about? I'm just curious on how you found yourself so involved.
On the nonprofit side, I think, well, on the education side, at least with schools, they're always looking for help. So if you want to get involved, you know, just first place I'll say, start at your kid's school, start at your nephew, your cousin's school, locally, because you would be surprised how much of an impact, you know, your couple of hours a week or a month would make, because they need help in terms of just having folks who have, you know, business experience and leadership experience to help support the growth of, you know, of the schools, or in some cases, just the sustainability of what they're trying to build. So I would say start there. That's always a good place to start. There are also organizations, and I am, and there's, yes, I remember, Board Lead is another organization that actually helps folks place into nonprofits. In fact, that's how I got connected with Christina Cultural Arts Center. I would say a Google search away is not just Board Lead. There's a bunch of other organizations that do that. So I would highly recommend that, actually, because they would, you know, interview you, do the vetting with you, and then they'll do the hard work of matching you to nonprofits that not only meet your interests, but also your skill sets as well, and your desired area.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you for that. So you also have a bit of an entrepreneurial spirit as well. Yes. So talk to me a little bit about that, and, you know, what you've worked on in the past, and, you know, what led you down that road.
Yes. So as I mentioned to you earlier, I've always had this, you know, continuous desire to make an impact in Nigeria, where I was raised. And so this was probably 2013 or so, when I just started at Deloitte. I reconnected with an old friend of mine from college, and we shared that same desire. And so really, we looked at a couple of trends that were happening. One was the proliferation of smartphones in Africa, specifically. Cloud computing that made, you know, starting a, you know, a tech business a lot more accessible to the average person. That was another main trend. And then we also were looking at, okay, if we look at those two things combined, what are the industries that we think would drive real impact and make, you know, call it sustained change for a long time? And we picked on education. So clearly we weren't trying to make a lot of money. So, but we looked at education and we felt, okay, so maybe ed tech. And then for me, with my call it affinity for, you know, call it data analytics, I felt, you know what, we have all these tools that we use to, you know, tell business leaders how to make the most efficient decisions to drive shareholder value. Well, why aren't we leveraging them to drive better outcomes for students? So we set out to build this analytics platform for K-12 schools, and quickly understood that the data wasn't even available. So we pivoted to building solutions to help digitize the data within schools, and then had the analytical tools on top of it. So it was a passion project, but we actually built it in a way that, you know, we wanted to make money out of it, because again, thinking about long-term sustainability, we wanted it to be self-sufficient. Unfortunately, COVID hit. We had our expenses in US dollars and our revenue in Naira, they're depreciated significantly during that period. And so, long story short, we ended up selling the business to, you know, our top competitor in the space. But I would say I learned so much from the process. And I think we left our little mark in the space, because by the time we're done, we had about, you know, 50 schools, and we had impacted, you know, a good number of students within that space. And just having that, giving folks that exposure that, oh, actually technology can be applied in the education space, and here's what it can really do, was something that was really satisfying. So I don't know that I'm all the way down there, but I'm definitely taking a little bit of a break right now from that.
Yeah. Cool. You mentioned being raised in Nigeria. What was your journey to the States like?
Oh, yeah. It was, I would say, unexpected. I didn't even, not in my wildest dreams did I think I would be in the United States, you know, studying and then, of course, now living. But I was lucky that my older brother, he was studying in Florida, doing a postdoctorate in Florida at the time I was graduating high school. And he suggested that I take the SATs. I was like, oh, really? Okay, great. Sure, why not? But at the time, I also applied to schools in Nigeria. So I took the SATs, scored well enough to, get admitted to a number of schools. But I ended up choosing Lincoln University because, one, they gave me the most scholarship. And two, there's actually a connection back to Nigeria. The first Nigerian president went to Lincoln, as well as the first Ghanaian president, actually, where both, or he was also an alum of Lincoln University. So there was that affinity there that brought me to Lincoln University specifically. But I would say to the U.S., it was my older brother who was already studying, here, and thought it'd be a good idea for me to come here. And here I am. Many, many years later.
Yeah, yeah. Great. You mentioned, you didn't mention, I read this on your LinkedIn, that you're a girl dad. How has parenthood helped influence your leadership philosophy and, the way you think about teams and just how you relate to people on a personal level?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. I would say the number one, especially at the age they are now, 13 and 9, listening. And patience. Really, really, really important skills as a girl dad and as a parent generally. I would say I definitely bring those into the workspace and saying, okay, being patient and taking a moment to listen first. I really understand, what is the point that this person is really trying to make and what do they really want, right? Mm-hmm. Is a big one. Managing different personalities. My two girls couldn't be more different. One is more hands-on, creative, and the other is more, technophile. Like she wants to, she's a gamer, right? And all of that. So, understand that you come from the same, gene pool and just end up very differently. So that can happen in my household. Then in the workplace, you could expect that, even though folks may either look alike or they look differently, whatever it is, you can't make assumptions based on what you see, right? You can't, what's the phrase, don't judge a book by its cover. So really taking the moment to get to know people and recognize that they all bring value to the table is the lesson that I would take from that. Investing in growing people, obviously. I'm investing in my kids, because I know, I would say my personal outcome that I'm hoping to get out of that is, hey, when I retire, they'll take care of me too, right? Invest in your kids so they'll take care of you in your old age. But the work front, investing in people, right? So, everyone succeeds. They do well, you do well, the company does well. And I think the most important one for me as a parent is really, set the bar high and they will rise to it. And even if they fall short, they're still higher than where, they would have aspired to if you hadn't set the right expectations. Right. So I am, my daughters would in some cases say, well, dad, you're a little bit tough or strict. I'm just, well, it's because, like I said, having high expectations, is a good thing. But of course, understand that you don't have to go in the deep end, but I really, really believe in, setting the bar high so that, they can aspire to it. And in the workplace, I said the same thing. I do the same thing because, again, that's what I expect of myself. So I'm not going to set expectations for others that I myself can't live up to.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Well, we're coming up on time. Is there anything else you want to leave the audience with before we head out?
Oh, wow. I would say, you know, first of all, this has been a great, great conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And the only thing I would say is, you know, just go out, you know, life is short. You know, go out, enjoy it, you know, value people, get to, you know, spend time to connect with people. You have the most fun at work with people that you know deeply and love. And it's hard to demonize people that you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Stephen, my friend, as always, it's been a pleasure. Thanks again for appearing on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
If you enjoyed today's guest and you'd like to help support the show, please subscribe, leave a rating, and share this episode. As always, thank you to our listeners, and be sure to tune in to the next episode of Executive Runtime.